This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Wiley Cash's debut novel is set in the mountain town of Marshall, North Carolina. The plot revolves around a charismatic preacher and his hold over the town's people. A terrible incident in the church causes one member in the congregation to break away and take some children with her. Years later, there's another tragedy. A boy is dead, and fingers point in the preacher's direction. Readers follow a sheriff, a 9-year-old boy, and the town midwife through this richly drawn portrait of small-town life. The novel is called A Land More Kind Than Home. Wiley Cash wrote it. He'll be at Flyleaf Books tonight, but first he joins us in the studio. Welcome, Wiley Cash. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me. This is great.
Tell us more about this book now. Give us a little more of the
book. That was a great summary. I'd like to see if we can use that for the paper.
We got it down to one page. You're up to about 300 here, but
yeah,
they're all good.
Well, your summary was wonderful. As you said, it's a book. It's set in Western North Carolina, and it's about, you know, the fallout in the community after a young boy faces tragedy at a small church with newspaper covering the windows and all kind of mysterious happenings going on inside.
Yeah, and it does involve snakes.
It does involve some snakes, but not a lot of snakes. But
right.
Enough snakes to make it mean something.
And so tell us about the idea. Where did the idea for this book come from?
Well, I went to graduate school in Lafayette, Louisiana, and I was taking a class in African-American literature and spirituality. And one of my professors, a guy named Reggie Young, who I'm still really good friends with, brought in a news story about a young autistic boy in an African-American church out in the Midwest who had been smothered during a healing service. And I just thought, it's obviously very tragic, but I was really interested in the power of a community to literally believe something to death, you know, to take their convictions right up to the edge and perhaps over. And I wanted to tell that little boy's story, but I'd never been out to Chicago. I certainly couldn't speak for the African-American community out there, but I knew about Western North Carolina. You know, I know.
Yeah, you're from North Carolina.
Yes, sir. I was raised in Gastonia and went to school in Asheville and lived there for a lot of years. So I knew I could put the book there and make it come to life, and hopefully that's what I did.
Did any of the initial story resonate with your experiences there, or did you have to go back and do research when you put this novel together?
Well, I wasn't raised in a snake handling holiness church or a Pentecostal church, mm-hmm. but I was really always interested in the holiness movement. I took a class in Appalachian history in college, and we did some study on the holiness movement and snake handling and you know, the science following movement, which is what that's called. And I was just really interested in that. And there's a wonderful documentary that people can see online if they want to, called Holy Ghost People. And that's a documentary made in 1967 of a worship service in a Pentecostal church. And it's pretty enthralling.
You've got three narrators we focus on. How did you develop their characters?
Well, they were kind of a natural progression of the story. I mean, this is as much a mystery as it is anything else. You know, no one really knows. No one person knows for sure what this little boy is doing inside the church. No one person knows for sure why the congregants are staying quiet about the incident. And so each of these three characters kind of represents a piece of knowledge the reader needs to put the mystery together. It's kind of like a trial where everybody testifies about their knowledge of the case.
You know, but it's interesting because it would seem to me, if I may, that some of your characters also have a kind of missing piece. There's a mm-hmm. hole in each of them, a bit of a mystery about
absolutely.
Them.
Absolutely.
So you know, we're sort of uncovering the drama, the mystery of the plot, but each of us is sort of trying to figure ourselves out, and there's a part that we can't get unless the rest of the community is in the room.
Absolutely. I think each of the characters, each of the three narrators, deals with loss in their own lives, and they're trying to repair the loss this community has faced, you know. And I think a lot of us deal with those kind of things. You know, we wake up every day trying to patch whatever hole we've got in our lives.
Would you read for us?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'll read a couple of just a short section from the sheriff's perspective. He is an outsider. He's from Henderson County, which is right down the interstate from Madison County. But this is from his perspective. His name is Clem Bearfield. One thing I can say about people up here is that they're different from folks in Buncombe or Henderson County or any other place in these mountains. Most people up here claim they've got Irish or Scottish or some kind of blood in them, and I think that's probably true, especially if you listen to the folks who will drive up here from the universities to tell you all about the culture they say is disappearing. Then they'll go and knock on cabin doors looking to get jacktails on their tape recorders, snoop through barns, flag elderly men down from tractors to ask them to sing a couple of the old-time reels. I'd always heard that it's a different world up here, and sometimes I wonder if it might just be. When I came over from Henderson, I'd drive through this county and see signs and markers for towns like Mars Hill and places like Jupiter and all kind of things like that. And I'd think, Jesus, Clem, how'd you end up here? But I'll be damned if it's not beautiful. These green fields where farms line the ridges and the spaces in between hide dark hollers and deep coves where the sunlight might not ever reach. Like I said, I've spent almost 25 years working this county, but I can guarantee you there's places I've never seen. Places that would seem just as strange to me now as they would have when I first stepped foot in Madison County. I've gotten right used to feeling that way. And sometimes, after you've lived in a place long enough, it becomes harder and harder to pick out the things about it that once seemed strange, even if most folks still consider you an outsider after 2.5 decades, just because you weren't born here and raised up knowing everybody's business.
Wiley Cash reading from his debut novel, A Land More Kind Than Home. He's going to be at Flyleaf Books tonight at 7 o'clock in Chapel Hill, but with us here on The State of Things Today. You know, faith is such a powerful thing, and it can be so destructive and yet so powerful and mm-hmm. healing. Were these the questions that sort of interested you? Because I think about how in filling these holes and filling these gaps, we project on a whole community our deepest fears, and that's when faith becomes a destructive thing. And it's certainly evident in the mystery of your book. And I wondered how much of that had been important to you before you began this novel.
Well, I've always been really interested, not just in faith, but by people who become intoxicated with any kind of power. A lot of folks have asked me, you know, did you set out to write a book with an evil minister in it? And I said, no, you know, he was a product of the story. This could have been an evil banker. This could have been an evil politician, because I think it's, you know, money, religion, and political power that people get intoxicated by. And I've just really been interested. You know, I'm a child of the 80s. So I was raised in Gastonia, and PTL, Jim and Tammy Faye Baker right next door, and Jerry Falwell and Jimmy Swaggart. So I saw a lot of this stuff happen when I was a kid. And in the novel, we have a 9-year-old boy watching a lot of the same things happen in his community and asking himself questions, you know. Where does this power come from? Why is it so effective? Is this something I should be believing in, or is this something I should be questioning?
Yeah, the loss of innocence, I think, or that age on the threshold of maturity mm-hmm. is something that comes through and is, I think, adds a lot to the mystery we follow this child through, not only in the mystery he's trying to solve locally, but his own coming of age.
Absolutely. But I think what's important in this book is that, you know, the same thing that breaks this community is going to be the same thing that heals it. And I think the novel ends on a pretty satisfying note in that respect.
Tell us how this novel came about, because you were a creative writing student,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
And so tell us the story.
Well, I was down in Lafayette, Louisiana, and I had the great honor of studying fiction writing under Ernest J. Gaines, who I think is the South's greatest living writer. He wrote A Lesson Before Dying and Autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman. And, you know, he's a man who grew up in Southwest Louisiana and left it because he had to in 1948, because there were no schools for African-American children. And once he left Louisiana, he realized it was all he could think about. So it was all he ever wrote about. And although, you know, my act of reclamation is not nearly as revolutionary as his, but when I left North Carolina, I had it in my blood more than I ever did when I lived here. And so, you know, writing this novel, living in the swamps of Louisiana, was a chance to come home, and it was pretty wonderful.
Ernest Gaines, yeah, A Lesson Before Dying is one that talks deeply about how we internalize the values of a community.
Absolutely.
And then sort of how we either heal or don't
mm-hmm.
from that experience. The book itself was languishing for a while. It was your PhD project, was it?
It was, yeah. It was my dissertation, and I finished it in the summer of 2008. Well, I thought I finished it in the summer of 2008. And I worked on it over the next couple of years, and it went through one agent and then found its way to another. And actually, the editor who purchased it with William Morrow is from Raleigh. So when we talked, it was an instant connection, and I was just so happy to.
Also, you are also a big fan of Thomas Wolfe.
I am, absolutely. You won't see that in my own fiction. It's much more pared back, but I'm a big Thomas Wolfe fan. I really love his work.
Now, you're touring now and going to independent bookstores.
Absolutely.
Only independent bookstores?
Absolutely. We're doing all independents except in Lafayette, Louisiana, where there's no indies, so we're doing Barnes & Noble. And I've gotten a lot of support from Barnes & Noble, but it was really important to us. You know, this is a small book. I've got a weird name and a long title, and it's set in North Carolina. And we knew that if this book was ever going to do anything, the independents were going to do it for us. And they've just been, the indie community has just been outstanding. It's just such an amazing
Have you been to Western North Carolina with a book yet?
I haven't. Not since the book's been out. We're going to be at Malaprops on Saturday and at City Lights Bookstore in Sylva, North Carolina on Friday night. So
I wonder how this has changed your idea. You said that you couldn't get North Carolina out of your system when you went away, and then you come back and you sort of investigate these themes for the novel. How much of your ideas about North Carolina changed, or did they, in the process of writing this?
I don't think that they changed necessarily. I think that I was able to see it more clearly. You know, if you want to see the distinction between two colors, put them side by side. And that's what I did when I went to Louisiana. And I suddenly heard the voices of North Carolina people. I suddenly, you know, heard bluegrass that I'd always listened to. I really heard it for the first time once I left. And whenever I get to come back, it's a real treat to come and kind of reimmerse myself in this place.
How about the characters themselves, drawn from people you know?
I think, you know, famous North Carolina writer Charles Chestnut said, you know, fiction is only the power of rearranging your memory. So I imagine there's a little bit of some folks I know and found their way into this book.
You don't want to name the model for this preacher in the book, I tell you.
I don't know that there is a model necessarily. I mean, you know, American history is full of ne'er-do-well religious leaders and politicians and all kind of stuff. So, you know, if I thought about it long enough, we might could attach him to somebody.
It's interesting because in a lot of ways, this guy is just pure evil in some ways. And he borders on the improbable, and then he's not. And I wonder if you as a writer had to sort of work with that in some ways his behavior is a caricature. But you named a few preachers who came perilously close to this guy's behavior.
Yeah, yeah.
And who
yeah.
knows how many people they've left in the tomato field after a bad healing.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think those models are definitely out there. You know, I think Carson Chambliss is a man who believes the myths he's created about himself. Mm. And when people start doing that is when they get in trouble, regardless of what their job is. That's when they get in trouble.
You construct that identity too strongly and it becomes too divorced from reality. That narcissism is perhaps the definition of pure evil. So it can be among us and well wrought in your book. How about Jess, the young boy in this character, one of them? How much of your childhood is invested in that character?
Well, I think a lot of it. I mean, Jess is a little boy. This novel set in 1986. He's 9 years old. I was 9 years old in 1986. So I think a lot of, you know, the child's wonder comes into it, things I remember about the world of adults and perceiving things and intuiting things, but not necessarily being fully able to process all that I was taking in. So I think that, you know, found its way in. I also spent, you know, my whole life playing outside in the woods and at the creek and all that stuff. So it was really wonderful to kind of go back and revisit those things.
And the plot is pretty well integrated here, too. Our sheriff in this community is someone who is suffering a loss, and his own personal tragedy plays an important part in the way that it comes back to play a part in this.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was important to me. I think when I first started writing the novel, I spent so much time developing these characters. And the more I developed them, the more I saw the ways in which they were linked. And it wasn't until much later that I kind of caught myself thinking, man, this thing's got to have a plot. This can't just be a novel about just the characters and their lives. And so, you know, the central action is this terrible tragedy. But I think the focus on the characters gave rise to really their histories and their connections and their role in the community. And, you know, that's really, really what life is. You know, our stories only come about because of who we are.
You're teaching writing now.
I am, yes.
How has writing this book affected your teaching? How much of this experience do you bring to
class? Well, I just finished a semester of teaching at Bethany College in West Virginia, and I teach in a low residency MFA program at a Southern New Hampshire university. So, you know, when I'm teaching, especially at the residential college, I don't have quite as much time to devote to my writing as I'd like to. But I think one thing that teaching writing does is it keeps you grounded in the act of writing, and it gives you respect for the process because, you know, you ask your students, you know, hey, come bring a 20-page story in next week, and they bring it, you know, and you think, man, I haven't written 20 pages in 1 week in my life, you know, so it makes you, you know, appreciate the work, and it makes you appreciate the word, and it makes you an honest reader of your own work because you're telling other folks what's wrong with theirs.
As you create this framework and say,
exactly.
When was the last time I honored that idea?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But But and in terms of the process, I mean, this was your dissertation. It was something that you were doing strictly as a student. Mm-hmm. You said it went through many changes in the process of getting it published. How much did it change?
It changed a good bit. The first draft of it was in four sections. There were two sections narrated by Jess, the little boy, and then one section by the sheriff, and then one section by Adelaide, the church matriarch. And as I said, it was much more of a character study. It was much more of their reaction to this horrifying tragedy. But as I began to revise it and go back to it, the plot definitely was amplified. And I realized that to keep the plot moving forward, you know, this is being described as a literary mystery or a literary thriller. In order to keep the plot moving forward, I had to shorten a lot of scenes. I had to shorten a lot of sections. And I really focused on ending a section in a way that makes the reader want to spring forward into the next section, you know. Not necessarily a cliffhanger, but certainly a little planted idea of what's going to happen next.
You write a lot of short fiction as well.
I started out writing short fiction, yeah, yeah.
Do you have a preference?
I think I like novels better now. And I'm working on a short story now that I've been working on for quite a while, and I keep having dreams about not finishing it, which is strange. I can't even believe I admitted that. But I think I like novels better because I can really develop a community, and it was really important to me because I love North Carolina so much to get the community mm-hmm. right. And I feel like it took me 300 pages to do that in 5 years. So hopefully I can do it in, you know, maybe the same amount of pages but fewer years for the second book I'm working on.
Well, how does your inspiration come to you? Does much of it come to you sort of in an unconscious dream state or not thinking about it, or do you have to sort of...
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, we're all a product of the lives we've led and the experiences we've had. So I think a lot of my ideas for stories come from, you know, everyday life. You know, you overhear something or you see something beautiful or you see something tragic and you think, well, how can I make that my own? You know, I love literary models. I love reading something and think, man, I'd love to tell a story like that. How can I make it my own? So I think a lot of my inspiration comes from that. So
now you went to school in Louisiana. Louisiana, you're teaching in West Virginia. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine writing books and stories located there? Place is an important part of this
yeah,
novel.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a pretty vivid character.
I don't think that I can necessarily. William Faulkner, and I'm by no means comparing myself to his genius, but he thought of Oxford, Mississippi as a little postage stamp of Earth, and North Carolina is obviously a lot bigger than that. And I'm thankful for it because I plan on mining that for the rest of my writing life.
All right. So what's next do you have? You talked about a short story that you're a little anxious about getting done.
Yeah, I'm trying to finish that, but I'm working on a second novel, which is set in Gastonia, North Carolina, where I'm from. And it is about a washed-up minor league pitcher who kidnaps his two daughters from a foster home. And it's a really fun and really exciting to kind of go back in my mind and talk about landmarks and places that I love about my hometown. So it's kind of an homage to Gastonia.
Well, we will have you back when you finish that.
Great.
Hopefully it'll take you
it.
A little less time than
Absolutely.
This.
Absolutely. I'm sure my publisher hopes the same thing.
It'll be your second one, not your first. Wiley Cash, thanks so much for being
here. Thanks
on
for
the
having
program.
Me.
Wiley Cash teaches English at Bethany College in West Virginia. He's the author of A Land More Kind Than Home. He's in Chapel Hill tonight, 7 o'clock, Flyleaf Books, then Quail Ridge Books and Music in Raleigh tomorrow at 7:30. Going to be at the Regulator Bookshop in Durham Thursday. 7 o'clock. For more information, go to WileyCash.com. Wiley is W-I-L-E-Y. Just ahead, find out the most important role, in fact, that numbers can play in the history of rock and roll. Stay with us on The State of Things.